Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative medicine practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, and thanks for your company today. Today we're joined by Christine Pope, a naturopath nutritionist, and today we'll be discussing how to age outrageously. Christine, welcome to Natural Medicine Podcast. How are you?
I'm well, and I'm glad to see you are aging outrageously, Andrew.
Aging outrageously, certainly. Responsibly, not at all. Christine, first let's sort of set the background. I've podcasted with you a number of times, but for our listeners here today, can you just take us through a brief history of your career and a little bit prior to doing naturopathy? Because it's a very interesting background.
Thanks, Andrew. Well, look, my first career after I left uni was actually in investment banking. I was actually with Macquarie Bank for about 14 years. And my background was risk management, looking at lending proposals and structuring transactions to minimise risk. Then I decided I needed a career change. So I thought I would take a less stressful job in venture capital, which turned out to be a much more stressful job. I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but I thought I needed to change. Turned out I needed a much bigger change. So I worked with a career coach and decided that, you know, right back when I was looking at studying, I was looking at commerce or chiropractic. At the time, the only chiropractic courses were in Melbourne and it was a big move. So 17 years old, wasn't quite ready to do that. But also I think actually with more life experience, naturopathy was a better option. You know, I think it would have been really hard to practice as a 20, 21-year-old.
But it's a pretty diverse sort of choice from venture capital finance, hardcore numbers, on-off mathematics, defined limits and parameters, to naturopathy, which is, you know, let's face it, we go a lot with the flow. We look at vitality. We observe people. So there's a lot of psychology and a lot of more nuanced decisions to make. So what drew you to naturopathy rather than, say, well, even chiropractic, osteopathy, but what about one of the other sciences? The world was your oyster.
Look, I wasn't really that interested in science at school because, frankly, teaching wasn't great. And I did physics, which is more maths-based anyway. And chemistry, which I quite enjoyed, because how can you not enjoy a subject that involves blowing things up? Well, that's not what you're supposed to be doing, but, you know, we always manage
no.
to.
No.
But I think one of the things is, if I look at nutrition and naturopathy, a lot of it is about risk management, ultimately. It's the same thing, you know, with your health. What are the risks you're taking? How can you manage it effectively? How can you manage it more effectively? How can you encourage people to make those changes? Which, let's be honest, the compliance is the biggest challenge.
Very true. And which is really funny when you think about the patient's decision to come and see you in the first place.
Yeah.
I want something to be done, but I want you to do magic. I've actually told patients, you know, that I've said, look, sorry, look, like I'll always remember one guy. Will this totally prevent me having prostate cancer? And I said, no, there's a magic store two doors down though. If you go down there, I'm sure they can help you. And I said, no, you need to have a think about what your goals are here. We can look at reducing your risk. Nothing is 100%.
Yes, exactly. But I do think, you know, it was also that personal journey where I'd gone down the path with mainstream medicine where every drug I was ever given, I reacted to because I'm quite sensitive. And it, you know, it started to make me fearful about getting sick because I was worried that what would the treatment do to me?
That's an interesting point, though, about sensitivity. Yeah. And I mean, what we're talking there about is biotransformation of drugs. Yeah. So how our liver works
and other processes in the body about what other people call detox. And it's not uncommon for people to say, I've had a bad reaction to that drug.
Mm.
Let's say the generic, but yep. not the trade name, or vice versa. The don't give me the trade, oh, wow. give me the generic.
I think in practice too, I probably attract a more sensitive group of patients as well. So I'm always really careful to make sure that I'm managing dosing. I think, you know, some practitioners are like, go hard or go home. And I'm like, go low, go slow. Just see, is that enough? I mean, look, with natural medicine, look, you're more likely to die from a bee sting than a natural medicine intervention. That's a quote I've stolen from another practitioner, but the reality is, you know, most of the reactions will tend to be a bowel reaction, you know, it'll just go straight yeah. through. But again, I think everyone has their own individuality. And I think for me, looking back, I do think my liver was not functioning particularly well. And a lot of the reactions were very dose dependent.
Right.
You give everyone the same size dose, stands to reason some people don't need it.
That's exactly true. And like I come from, you know, the nursing, so I was one of the go high, go hard sort of thing. And then I learned my lesson rather saliently. And I used to sometimes use a challenge dose, but I'd always warn the patient and say, this is the reason I'm doing this. Please don't get frightened if something untowards happened. It's going to be of this sort of nature, headaches, that sort of thing, nausea. And the reason is because I'm challenging your liver or something. And there's a point to it. And the reason is because we could waste time finding the right dose for you, or I could challenge you and say, that's not right. But I'll only do that now with certain remedies, with certain
nutrients. Yes.
Like, for instance, you know, BioResponse DIM. Having said that, I do battle because sometimes I'll, as you say, question them and say, I think you're actually a slow metabolizer.
Mm.
Let's go slow. So there's something, and this is more to do with taking a good history. So it's a little bit off track. Welcome to my mind. but maybe that's something we should always ask our patients upon first history taking. How do you react to medicines, coffee, anesthetics, things like that?
Well, and, you know, it often expresses in food intolerances. You know, do they have food intolerances? Do they have reactions to personal care products? You know, a lot of women will, things that bring them out in a rash. You know, it's like the sensitivity is expressed, or are you sensitive to noise or light or other things that actually make it harder for you to cope with being in a, you know, a busy shopping center or something else like that. There are the whole range of signals that are actually people are more sensitive.
You know what? I'm going to change my intake form to include those. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I should be thinking more about things like noise and light and not just in migraineurs or people with epilepsy, but also people who have hypersensitivities to other things, even neuroatypical people, for instance.
Yeah, well, where it's very common, but also a certain demographic of men start to struggle with noise at venues, and they don't like going out to noisy restaurants, probably because they need to get the hearing checked. But apparently, raising that topic is rude, and you shouldn't do it.
Well, perhaps the beer's cheaper at home, but let's get back onto our topic, because what you said just then is actually pertinent. You said men start to. So as we age, we change. Our hearing does decline. Thank you, Midnight Oil.
yes, those nights at Selena's were not good for your hearing.
So let's talk more about this program that you've developed called Aging Outrageously. And I love the name of it, by the way, because it really captures me. How does it capture patients? Do you capture a certain type that wants to live free and happy and fun?
Look, I think I actually developed it more for the clients who were starting to notice that things were changing and declining, and perhaps they were already on a bit of a roundabout with doctors and specialist appointments. So having an online program was a good way for them to be able to access what I do. But also I found what I'm finding is it's actually having access to the recordings. It means they can go back, because I've had people come in a year, 18 months after they started seeing me and going, I know we talked about this and you told me what I should be doing, but actually I don't remember. So can we go over this again? So actually having access to the recordings is actually really useful. And look, it's not really a memory challenge at this point in their lives. It's most people, if they're working and they've got kids or they're, you know, they're dealing with elderly parents, they've got a lot going on. And I can get quite passionate about these topics. It perhaps isn't their passion as well.
You said recordings. Let's discuss that. What recordings are we talking about?
So the program actually involves 8 modules, and basically each module is about 20 to 30 minutes. So what I've deliberately designed them to be short, because I feel for most people more than half an hour is too much, and it's too much information and content, and they need time to absorb and deliver it. So the other thing I've done with the program is I've actually put in resources. You know, so depending on the topic, there'll be like a meal plan that's relevant to that topic or some testing. So the other thing I've incorporated, thanks to one of my partners, was a health appraisal, so that people can actually check in, see where they're at, what are the things they're struggling with. And then as they go through and implement the changes, they can actually see if things have shifted.
Health appraisals are an interesting tool from the way that a patient is answering the questions, whether they're always all high or always all low. You'll still get a trend, the bumps, the red flags, for instance.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing you really get in clinic as well, is I don't tend to get people to fill out questionnaires when they come into clinic. I usually do it as part of my case taking, because I found that the information wasn't granular enough for me in most questionnaires. And also, by the time they've spent 45 minutes filling it out, they're exhausted. So the one I'm using is a briefer one, and I'm using a mood and stress questionnaire as well, because I do think that, especially after the last couple of years, most people have got a level of anxiety that they're managing.
Isn't this an interesting time? Did you ever think that we would be coping with this level of chronic inflammatory stress? It's a funny, it's almost like and forgive me, I do not mean to belittle this condition at all, but it's almost like a mini post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm also going to catch myself there. Petraea King, it was, who said to me when I said those words, post-traumatic stress disorder, she looked me dead in the eye like an eagle, and she said, post-traumatic stress injury, an injury you can recover from. And I went, booyah, girl. I said, I bowed to her. I said, point taken, madam. So it just seems like we're dealing nowadays with this chronic smoldering stress that is going to cause inflammation, which will affect so many conditions.
Particularly going to have an impact on your brain, because any inflammatory condition starts to infect your brain. And, you know, it's whether it's people talking about things like brain fog, you know, post-COVID. But many of the people I see who have been chronically inflamed, like they've been in chronic pain. So chronic pain is probably the most common manifestation of that inflammation on an ongoing basis. And they find it hard to remember things. They find it, you know, they're not setting memory. And, you know, it really is having a significant impact on your brain overall. And I find when I look back over the last few years, it's like I feel like it was one long year in my memory. It doesn't seem to be two distinct years.
It's really funny, isn't it? Mm. It's really interesting how it really was a dream, a nightmare for me. Just incredible time. Never even contemplated that I would live through that. And, you know, I guess we have to thank our lucky stars that that was all it was, because it gives you some imagination of what people must go through in real horrible circumstances, like conflict, like war, you know, like abuse. So let's get back onto the thing about our aging outrageously and how this is part of that, with regards to people who have lived, you know, poor lifestyles, stressful lifestyles, bad food, they've got bad habits. What's the invitation to change?
Yeah. So how are you going to encourage them to change? I think one of the things for most people is if they're coming to something like the program, they're already in a headspace where they're actually prepared to make some changes. And then I think it's about trying to make it as simple as possible. So when I'm seeing someone in practice, I'm changing one meal a day. You know, I'm changing the breakfast and I'll work on that for a month. And then I'll work on changing breakfast and lunch. And maybe then you move to the third meal. So you need to understand that people make change gradually. They're not going to change everything in one hit. I mean, if I could, I'd just send everyone to Golden Door for 2 weeks, you know, and they have fantastic food. They'd see how good they felt exercising every day. They'd build up their exercise. They'd kind of burn through those plateaus and actually achieve and feel healthy for a change.
Yeah.
But for most people, you know, it's just focusing on having more vegetables. You know, this is something I bang on about all the time. 3 cups of vegetables a day, in my view, is a minimum. And if you look at the research, the two programs that I've drawn from, but I haven't taken everything on board because I think for most people without a coach and an integrative doctor and someone else, it's really hard to implement all those features. But what I've done is I've looked at what are the key things here and how can you pull that out and make it workable. So both Terry Walls and Dale Bredesen, who are the two people I've gone and seen present and have studied their protocols, have some really key features, which is cutting out inflammatory foods, which, let's be frank, for most people it's gluten or dairy, having a lot of vegetables and adequate protein. You know, if those are the three pillars that you can actually start with, you can still see a lot of improvement. I do remember one client of mine who I'd seen for a while, came back, had a lot of, was on thyroid medication, but when she came back, she was feeling terrible. And she didn't do well with supplements. So the one thing we did the first few weeks was just clean up her diet, just get her eating back to eating a really good, clean diet. And within 6 weeks, she was back to her old self. That was all she needed, was to actually stay off the alcohol, increase the vegetables back in her diet to eat the way she had been eating traditionally.
Yep.
And it just made such a significant difference.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think about it, vegetables are really critical because clearly that's where a lot of your nutrients are coming from. So everyone raves on about, you know, if you cut out dairy, won't you be getting enough calcium? It's like there are 20 nutrient minerals. Why don't we worry about any of them?
Mm. Let's talk a little bit more about critical areas that you sort of hone in on. Now, it's not just diet and lifestyle. You said about wheat and milk, for instance.
So, look, I think the thing is for about 70% of the population is lactose intolerant once they hit puberty. And, you know, those numbers can vary. Certain demographic groups, obviously, which didn't have dairy as part of their culture, are less likely to have the microbes that allow them to break down milk, and particularly as they get older, because, you know, as babies we're fed breast milk, so we obviously need to have lactase to break it down, but there wasn't a biological driver for us to have that as we got older. And, you know, you might have been breastfed once upon a time until you were 3 or 4 years old. Doesn't tend to happen so much nowadays, but typically then you find that people's ability to tolerate dairy actually reduces as they get older. And, you know, really, if you're not tolerating the food, and most people, you know, they've got symptoms, they're either full of mucus or they're bloated or flatulent or something like that, then you're probably not breaking it down and absorbing the nutrients from it anyway, and it's not really providing you with much value. You're going to get calcium out of your nuts and seeds, out of your vegetables. You know, there are many other sources of it. And I think the problem with dairy as the only source becomes that we crowd out things that have more nutrients in and that we can absorb.
Yeah.
And those nutrients are really important for all our other function as well. And I also wonder whether there's a role here with microbes, that our gut flora has changed and become less diverse and less competent at processing foods. And as we're starting to understand the research on that, it's like, okay, you've lost these strains and perhaps it was the one in the middle that actually helped you break down the lactose so that all of a sudden you can't tolerate it anymore. You know, is that what's changed?
Mm.
Is it the type of lactose we're having, or is it just the ridiculous quantity people are drinking?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, is that good for them? I tend to look more at fermented foods and particularly the fermented food from their culture.
That's right.
Because it's going to have the right cultures.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm.
Foods win again.
Yeah.
Wheat is something I've never settled with myself. I remember Alessio Fasano, and I said, okay, so is it, how big is this issue? And he said, it's bigger than just celiac. But he said, I don't believe that it's everybody should be avoiding wheat. But it's really interesting how it does benefit more than just celiacs if they have these ongoing inflammatory issues. Very interesting.
And I think that's why, you know, with both Terry Walls's protocol and Doug Bredesen's, they both cut out gluten and dairy because they are the most common allergens. But if you also think about it, if these people already have a lot of inflammation and other things going on, they're big proteins. So it's more likely that they're going to have problems with those and breaking them down and digesting them. So if you're basically trying to change the protocol to flood the body with nutrition, you don't want to basically have these things gumming up the works.
No. And at the very outside, what I'll say is, okay, how about then we try and move you at least to a good bread rather than the mass manufactured breads? And also if we can try and get you on one of these proteolytic enzymes that can at least reduce the allergenicity of some gluten. I won't say 100%, but at least it's some aid. So there's these products out there now.
Well, and just even, you know, good quality sourdough that's been raised for 24, 48 hours will have had a reasonable amount of the gluten broken down. And I always love that book, Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon, because it's a little bit of a cookbook and a little bit of a story. And a lot of the ways traditional foods were prepared were to maximize the nutrition from those foods because they're in an era of calorie deprivation. I mean, that's not the problem now. We don't have a problem with calorie deprivation, but it was also to make those foods digestible so that we could actually absorb the nutrients from them.
We've spoken about neurological activity, neurological inflammation, but what about things like task orientated stuff, learning new things that might increase BDNF, picking up a guitar and starting to learn music, things like that.
Exercise actually improves BDNF. So, you know, and one of the things I focus on is movement because it's important to be moving and different types of movement. Yeah. But I also include a couple of, I've got a chair yoga session, which one of the lovely practitioners here recorded for me, because I was trying to think about how can I get people who really haven't moved or are perhaps limited to start doing some movement. I've got a couple of Pilates sessions, which are designed for people who are more restricted in their activity, because the other thing too is both yoga and Pilates have the benefit of working on balance, and it helps promote that connectivity in the brain. But I also like, and I talk about brain training exercises. So there's a program called Brain HQ, which actually has been doing a lot of studies over the last 5 to 10 years. So if you jump on their website, there's a lot of information there about studies they've done. And they look at exercises. It is on a phone. And usually the hard thing is I'm trying to get people off devices for their brains. And, you know, this is something you do on a device, but it works on memory, reasoning, and speed of processing. And what I really struggle with is speed of processing. I've never been good at computer games or, you know, that. And I think it is interesting to see that is actually this, what they call double decision making, is actually the thing that's making a real difference for people in recovering brain volume and capacity.
Brain HQ.
Yes. And so the double decision making is like you're looking at something on the screen and there'll be like a picture of a car or a truck. And then round it, there is also a sign appearing in one of these quadrants, but it's happening really quickly. And you then have to say, okay, it was a car and the sign, which is Route 66, is here. So it's actually forcing you to engage with both areas of your brain and make decisions really quickly. So there's a range of activities around that, and I'm really bad at them.
I think part of it is also fun.
You know, because I think encouraging people to learn new things is really important. But it's also when you're out learning new things, you tend to be out with other people. You know, whether it's ballroom dancing or line dancing or learning a language or something else, using engaging your brain. And I think the important thing is you actually need to do things that challenge you. So if you're really good at maths, like I am, you don't actually want to be focusing on more maths because that's a skill you already have. You want to actually be doing something that's perhaps more language or movement, or for me, reverse parking, because I'm really bad at that. but, you know, it's something that challenges your brain.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Okay, so I have to ask, what are your thoughts on the term anti-aging medicine?
I don't really like it.
I'm with you.
My preferred term would be pro-aging, because I'm in favour of people being, you know, aging well and aging in a healthy fashion. I think anti-aging medicine, and I think Botox and starving yourself. That's just, you know, how my brain works. I actually think it's a privilege to be able to grow older and to rock grey hair, you know?
Well said. Hang on, let me just flick my hair, flick my golden, oh no, they're grey, locks. I totally agree, optimal aging, but it's aging. Part of this, I love what you just said, it's a privilege to grow old.
Exactly.
Man, if we could just have gratitude about growing old. There are a lot of people that don't have that
privilege.
Privilege, thank you. Oh, we just said the word and I've forgotten it.
Brain HQ, Andrew, Brain HQ.
Yeah, I've written it down, I tell you. Where can we find out more, Christine? Like, you've done this program. We need to promote this. This is such great stuff you're doing.
Thank you. Well, look, it's on my website, which is ChristinePopeNutritionist.com. And I'm also on social media as well, as Christine Pope, naturopath and nutritionist. So they're two easy ways to find out more about it. And I'm really happy if people want to email me in clinic as well, which is christine@elementalhealth.net.au.
So everyone, if you're a more mature person and you want to start living life with luster, then please look up Aging Outrageously on Christine's website and get involved. Christine, thank you so much for taking through your work today, because I know you and I are of the same sort of ilk, and there's this real joie de vivre in your complexion, the way you look after yourself, the way you carry yourself, but also your experiences, your life experiences. I think they've taught you a lot that you can share with others and help them along their journey.
Well, thanks, Andrew. That was one of the other motivators for my program, is I wanted to share all that knowledge.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We'll put up all of the information, the research, and definitely that Brain HQ up in the show notes. And of course, you can find this and the other podcasts on naturalmedicinepartners.com.au. I'm Andrew Whitfield Cook. This is Natural Medicine Podcast.